I am told that this is our best subscribed event ever.
Thus proving the reality of my book's title.
People really love Dead Jews.
Yeah. I mean, or we could say it's the success of Sapir in promoting hope and aspiration.
I think it's your book, actually. It's really your book. So why don't we just...
People really like the doom and gloom. They're not so interested in the hope and aspiration, sadly.
Though they are interested in the hope and aspiration. I think they're interested in both sides of the coin. But let's just give people just a few more seconds. We're now north of 200, I see, moving up to come in. You know, we try to do these things and stick to an hour. We realize people lead busy lives, and this is a lunchtime event, so they're probably munching on something while watching us chat. One of the things that I really enjoyed about these talks is that they've allowed us to really engage some of our readers, and a lot of our readers are really as engaged with Jewish life as you can ever ask for. So it's really a treat, not just for the people I've been able to have conversations with, but also for everyone who then makes themselves present and known in the question in the chat function. So since I now see we're pretty well subscribed, I am going to make a little formal introduction, keep it brief, and just tell people how we're going to structure the conversation today. So first of all, I want to welcome everyone to Horn, and I will not waste time with introductions, because if you are in this chat, you know who she is. You have read her books. You have probably read People Love Dead Jews, her most recent and I think universally acclaimed book. It got a sensational review, I'm very happy to say, in the New York Times. You wrote a sensational essay, introductory essay, to our fourth issue of Sapir. Sapir started about a year ago. It's a quarterly. We call it a Journal of Jewish Conversation. It is published by the Maimonides Fund. Our goal with every issue of Sapir is to think of one subject thematically. So the first issue was about social justice, then about power, then about continuity. And your essay was the introductory essay, really, I think, the touchstone essay in our issue on aspiration. And what we are really trying to do when I say Journal of Jewish Conversation is really make it a Jewish conversation, which is to say, this is not a neocon publication. I'm not trying to impose my political views on our authors. I'm trying to get a wide range of opinions, both across political lines, but also across different from Orthodox to Reform and secular Jews. I really want to make this a broad conversation. But I think one aspect that people really have focused on is this question of aspiration and what it is that we as Jews can start wanting, dreaming about, changing in the way that Jewish life takes place, both in the diaspora and in the United States. So we're very lucky to have you. We're very lucky to have been able to publish your essay. You and I will talk for about half an hour, and then I'm going to open it up to questions. And I've noticed in past conversations, nobody's been very shy about asking questions, not at all surprisingly. But I want to begin with something that you say in your essay. And I'd like you, Dara, to explain this to us. You talk about the lachrymose view of Jewish history. What is that? What is that view? And why have you been, and as I gather, often partial to it?
Oh, I would, first of all, I just want to say thank you to you and everyone in Sapir for including me here today. I'm really excited to be here and make sure everyone can hear me. This is working because I'm not getting the little yellow frame around my Zoom screen. We're good?
We're good.
Okay, awesome. Thank you. Really happy to be here. So I actually wouldn't say that I would say I wasn't partial to the lachrymose of Jewish history in the past, and now I'm maybe more partial to it. For those who aren't familiar with this, this is the Jewish historian, the 20th century Jewish historian, and I'm probably going to pronounce his name wrong, Salo Barone, I don't even know how to say his name, I just read it. Salo Barone had this, he was a Jewish historian who wrote these, like, you know, massive Jewish histories that were like 18 volumes of social and religious history of the Jews. And he, in all of his work, was pushing back against what he called the lachrymose view of Jewish history. Lachrymose being, meaning like tearful, like full of tears. And, you know, the idea that Jewish history was like this litany of horror, and that was what was so remarkable about it. It was sort of like, you know, this parade of you know, horrible destructions. And he was pushing back against this, saying, you know, well, actually these you know, moments of destruction, while they're there, which is, you know, perhaps not surprising in a long history, actually aren't so frequent and actually aren't really the defining feature of Jewish life. And really we need to be sort of like, not just celebrating, but really exploring and looking into sort of the many different ways that Jewish history has developed over the centuries. And that was really his argument. You know, I embraced that idea as a Jewish writer and scholar for really my whole career. So much so that I was always in my work pushing back against the idea that Jewish identity should be defined from the outside. Prior to this book, I wrote 5 novels. All 5 of my novels deal very deeply with you know, Jewish history, culture, belief, traditions, texts. I also have a doctorate in Yiddish and Hebrew literature. And I was always wanted this to be sort of this like autonomous civilization that was, you know, really, I wanted to focus on sort of the agency that Jews had in making the choices they made in each of the things I was exploring. I was so attached to this idea that I even used to challenge my readers about it. When I would do public events for my books prior to this book, I often would ask the audience, like, how many people here can name 4 concentration camps? And that's something a lot of readers can do. I would ask those same readers, how many people here can name 4 Yiddish writers? Because, you know, 80% of the people murdered in the Holocaust were Yiddish speakers. It's a famously literary culture. My question is really asking, you know, why do we care so much about how these people died if we like really don't care at all how these people lived? So that was always what I was sort of going for, was sort of agreeing with Barone's idea that we should, you know, garbage this idea of lachrymose view of Jewish history. I now have a little bit of a different take on this. And, you know, so I don't know how much I want to say about my book, but, you know, my new book, People Love Dead Jews, really is sort of, and I don't know if you want me to talk about like how I came to this change, but
No, that's precisely why I asked the question.
Oh, okay.
Talk away.
Yes. Well, so, you know, I started rethinking this approach that I had around 2018. And, you know, maybe some of your readers will have heard the story before, sort of how I came to this. For me, this started with sort of just a kind of a silly minor event in my life as a writer, which was Smithsonian Magazine asking me to write a piece for them about Anne Frank. And I got that request and I just felt overwhelmed with dread. I didn't want to do it. And the reason I didn't want to do it really was because I was really very dedicated to spending my work, you know, doing my work against this lachrymose view of Jewish history. I was like, you know, really, you want me to write like some long form piece about Anne Frank? Like, is that really what your readers want to hear? Unfortunately, the answer is yes, right? And, you know, for a mainstream magazine, the answer is yes. And, you know, and so what I did was at that point, you know, like every bone in my body is pushing against this idea of like, ugh, like I've never written for Smithsonian before, but now the first thing they want me to do is this piece about Anne Frank, like, come on. And that was when I remembered this stupid event that had happened at the Anne Frank Museum in Amsterdam earlier that year. And this was in 2018. You know, there's a story I tell in the book. I was a young Jewish man who worked at the museum. They wouldn't let him wear his yarmulke to work. They made him hide it under a baseball hat. He appealed to the board of the museum. The board deliberated for 4 months and then finally relented and let him wear his yarmulke to work. As I put it in the piece that I did write for Smithsonian, and it's now chapter 1 of the book, you know, 4 months is a very long time for the Anne Frank Museum to ponder whether or not it was a good idea to force a Jew into hiding. And, you know, that sort of encapsulates what this essay is about, which is, you know, people tell stories about dead Jews that make them feel better about themselves. And so what happened was I probably would have just left it at that and just wrote this like kind of obnoxious piece for Smithsonian, where, you know, literally the first line of that piece is people love dead Jews. I probably would have just left it there. But what happened was that piece came out in the fall of 2018. It was a few days after that piece came out was the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. At that point, New York Times calls me, you know, says somebody calls me up and is like, you know, would you like to write about dead Jews? You know, at that point, you know, I was, you know, and then 6 months later, it happens again in this synagogue in San Diego. And, you know, I was just, as I put it in the book, I sort of became the go-to person for the emerging literary genre of synagogue shooting op-eds. And I just thought, you know, I didn't apply for this job. And at that point, I kind of turned it over and I thought, you know, I've been avoiding this topic for 20 years.
Yeah,
maybe
yeah.
It's time to actually investigate it, right? Like, why have I been avoiding this? And I realized, you know, often the uncomfortable moments are where the story is. And so I thought, you know, I'm going to explore, like, dive into this discomfort that I have with this topic and sort of see where this goes. And that's how I ended up writing this book. So, you know, I now have like a little bit more, and this goes to what I talk about in Sapir. You know, I spent 20 years pushing back against this like lachrymose view of Jewish history. It's, you know, so now I spent a few years writing this book about this. But then what really sort of got to me was, since I have published the book, I now have hundreds and hundreds of messages that I've received from Jewish readers. And I say this in the piece in Sapir, from many walks of life, right? Old people, young people, religious people, secular people, people in the United States, people around the world. And they're all writing me the same message, which is, you know, I felt uncomfortable my whole life. I never understood why. This book articulated it for me. Thank you. You know, and then they say, I never told anyone this, but. And then they write like this horrible, like this like Megillah about like these like terrible things they've experienced in their life. And then they say, thank you for writing this book. Sometimes they say, can you help? Which is even worse. I'm sure you get that sometimes too from readers of your work.
Do you answer?
I mean, you know, look, I'm like, these people seem to think like I have a staff or something, like it's just me. And I'm like getting these hundreds of messages. I try, but it's hard to keep up with it. Really know what to say, right? I mean, I'm like, I'm not really, you know, like, can I help? I'm like, I don't know. But I have started sort of thinking about like, you know, what are the ways that we can handle this? So my attitude now toward this lachrymose view of Jewish history, as I put it in the piece in Sapir, is like, I no longer am dismissive of it the way I was for 20 years. But I also sort of see that like, you can sort of acknowledge that lachrymose view, but also see that what makes it interesting and valuable is not this litany of horror, but rather the creative resilience that it engendered. Like the reason that and that sort of to me is the really interesting pattern of Jewish history isn't this the litany of horror, but the responses to it. And that's sort of what I really dive into.
So one of the things that I found so redolent in your book and the essay, you know, this habit of people loving dead Jews is a habit in the Gentile world for sure. I mean, Anne Frank venerated living Jews, not so much. Auschwitz, a shrine, Israel, a colonialist apartheid state, et cetera. This happens in the broad world, but it's also a uniquely Jewish phenomenon. And I've never really quite known what to make of it. I visited Auschwitz once in my life. I visited in the company of, I was on assignment for the Wall Street Journal in Poland. And I just thought, okay, I'll pay a visit. And I was in the company of non-Jewish colleagues. They wept the whole time. All I wanted to do was get out as quickly as possible. And I mean, I really, it's like, get me back to Krakow, get me as far from this place as I possibly can go. I've never had a desire to go back. I've been invited at least on half a dozen occasions by various Jewish groups to come and accompany them for a March of the Living or for some commemoration or event. This is an aspect of Jewish identity that Jews themselves, especially in the diaspora, seem to me not only to have internalized, but to have made in many respects the central aspect of their Jewish identity. And I've always felt very uncomfortable with it for a whole variety of reasons. I'd like your reaction to why this is such a, it's, we're not just talking about people fetishizing, non-Jews fetishizing dead Jews, we're talking about Jews fetishizing dead Jews. And it seems like a fundamentally vexing, complex, and maybe, in my view, distorting way of looking at your experience.
Yes. So just to clarify, so when you're talking about it, it's specifically about around the topic of Holocaust commemoration. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Well, so I will tell you that I don't know how close you and I are in age, but I'm 44 and I went on March of the Living as a teenager. And I had won some contests actually. And I, you know, it was like,
you win a contest, you go to Auschwitz.
Well, I mean, it was not to go to actually, to be fair, the contest was to go to Israel. And what happened was I think that they were expecting older students to win this contest. And I was like, sort of like a major dork. And I won this contest when I was like 14. And there were not a lot of trips I could go on. And it was like, you had to spend the money that year. It's not worth explaining, but like that program, because they're all about volume, we're looking for people. And it was like the only trip to Israel because they go to Poland and Israel.
Yeah.
So I was, in other words, it was like a kind of a weird circumstance where, yes, as you said, I was supposed to win a trip to go to Israel, but it ended up being also to Auschwitz. Why not, right? So I did do that trip. I remember what, and I did, I actually wrote about it and published about it at the time. And, you know, what I remember about sort of being a teenager in that time in the early, you know, in the early and mid 1990s was that it was, you know, going to those sites, like it was, you know, I did find it moving. So I was very young. I mean, I turned 15 and Treblinka. But like, it was, yeah, fun. But what sort of, you know, I do remember feeling like it was very moving. And, you know, and I was aware of all the sort of idea that this was some kind of emotional manipulation and whatever, but like, you know, no, I mean, I did find it moving. But what I remember about those those kinds of trips, and also like that the Holocaust Museum opened in Washington in 1993. I was sent by some teen magazine to cover it. You know, that was something else I wrote when I was a teenager. You know, those projects were like, there was something, and this I do write about in the book, there was something hopeful about the premise. And I think that what happened was you had this movement in the Jewish community in, you know, in the 19, starting maybe in the 1980s or 1990s, with this idea that Holocaust survivors were aging, and that there was this idea that they were going to inoculate the American public against anti-Semitism by like encouraging this Holocaust education. And there
apparently
was,
it didn't work.
What?
Apparently it didn't work.
I mean, yeah, well, that's what I say in the book. I'm sort of like, you know, it wasn't a ridiculous idea, but it seems to have been proven wrong that like, you know, you would go to these museums or learn this in school, learn what the world did to the Jews, see where hatred could lead, and then stop hating Jews. Like, well, you know, the problem is like, you know, now it's like if you're being trolled on by anti-Semites on social media and they're like photoshopping you into a gas chamber, the problem with that person is not that they don't know about the Holocaust, right? Like they know about the Holocaust. So to your point about like, you know, that there's a lot of, there are Jews who sort of were like, sort of, I mean, that this come, that the sort of, you know, obsession about Holocaust commemoration comes from Jews. I mean, it did, because I think that those projects kind of originated in this community in the 1990s or a little earlier. And the idea was that this was going to be a way to inoculate the public against anti-Semitism. You know, I think now we can reevaluate that. But I do think that like, what I see now is like, there's a shift in how this is done. And so like you said, there are people for whom this is their identity, but I don't see it as like this, I don't see it as this binary thing where there's like Jews over here and there's non-Jews over here and we react to this differently. I think there are like people who have a deep education in Jewish civilization. And so it's not even about whether you're religious or not. It's like whether you know or familiar or comfortable with this civilization. There's people who are educated in Jewish civilization and people who aren't. And I think that what happens is like, you know, there are a lot of Jews in the people who aren't category. And those people, because we sort of, you know, as the Jewish community sort of did this strategic thing where they decided to like invest in Holocaust education for the non-Jewish public, the result of that was that there are many Jews in that category who, what are they learning about being Jewish? Well, they're learning the same thing that non-Jews are learning, because they're learning what they're learning in public school, which is, you know, this is what happened to Jews. So what my interest is that like, why, you know, there was that strategy of that's what we're going to teach the non-Jewish public about Jews. I actually think that that's the piece that can be reevaluated, and that's where I think that there's a lot of room for fruitful possibilities, to go back to the topic.
So I remember when the film, I'm a little bit older than you, not too much, but a bit older. I remember when the film Schindler's List came out. I think I was in college, or it was just after college. And I seem to be the only person who hated it. And I mean, hate is a strong word. There's some great performances in there. But I really walked out of the movie not liking it at all. And I could never quite articulate what it was, other than the excessive, the unrestrained emotionalism that's a hallmark of Spielberg films. I couldn't quite put my finger on it, but listening to you, I'm just sort of thinking about it once again. And I'm thinking that that movie did two things, very much in tune with the zeitgeist of the early 90s that you're describing, that turned out to be less beneficial for Jews than most people thought at the time. One was the universalization of the Jewish experience, which we now know as man's inhumanity to man, thanks to the wisdom of Whoopi Goldberg. And the second thing was the reduction of Jewish experience and Jewish identity to this moment of absolute helplessness and abject victimization, right? So it both erased Jewish identity, it erased the Jewish identity of the Holocaust itself. It was just man's inhumanity to man. And to the extent that Jews were recognized as a people in any way, it was simply that they were members of a victimized category, which is why something distressing about the fact that Jewish identification always seems to rise to a fever pitch when there is an outrage against Jewish lives, whether it's at the Tree of Life synagogue in Pittsburgh, or most, you know, the recent attack in outside of Fort Worth, Texas, but otherwise is quiescent. So because what we're talking about is aspiration, I guess what I'd love to know your thoughts on is, how do we start to turn this around? Because the formula that I call the Schindler's List formula, I just started calling that 20 seconds ago, the Schindler's List formula clearly was not working very well for the Jewish community, or hasn't worked very well.
Well, so I'm a little bit ahead of you in 20 seconds on Schindler's List, because I don't write about it in my book, but I have a whole episode of my podcast about it.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that. I'll have to listen to it.
Yeah. So my podcast is called Adventures with Dead Jews. Tells totally different stories that aren't in the book, because, you know, this is a bottomless topic. You know, no shortage of dead Jews. So yeah, and in that episode, I talk about it's very much exploring what you're talking about. And the idea is that, like, Jews are only, you know, acceptable if they're powerless and have no agency, right? And so that's the appeal of that story. And and I talk about it in Hollywood terms, like Save the Cat, right? Which is this like screenwriting thing where, you know, you show who the hero is by having them in the first 10 minutes of the movie, like, you know, help some animal or something, right? That's like it's like a screenwriting shortcut. And so what I say toward the end of that episode is, like, the problem is, like, the American Jewish community, like, saw that movie and they're like, yay, hooray. It's like this Hollywood movie about Jews. But it was like, you know, the Jews, like, they thought they were the heroes of that movie, but they're actually just the cat. Right? They're the cat that's saved, right? So they're just the cats. And so, I mean, that's, yeah, they're like, there are like basically no Jewish characters in that movie. Like, even Ben Kingsley, like, he only has like four lines. So, but to go to your point, yes, there is, that is one way that it's acceptable to be Jewish in a non-Jewish society, is to have no power. Right. And so to be powerless, whether that means politically impotent or dead, right? But basically to have no agency, that's a way that's acceptable to be Jewish in public in a non-Jewish society. So that's one of the reasons that became this sort of, this story became so popular, like this Holocaust education became so popular. But it's also, as you say, total erasure of Jewish culture. And that's what I find really disturbing now, is that, you know, you go, there's this attempt in American Jewish, in American education, when we educate people against bigotry, what we usually say is something like, oh, see this group of people over here that you might be prejudiced against? You shouldn't hate them because they're just like everybody else. They're just like you and me. Of course, the problem with that is, you know, Jews spent 3,000 years not being like everyone else, right? And that's sort of, you know, and also, like, the Nazi project was not just about murdering 6 million Jews. It was about erasing Jewish civilization. And so, but instead we have this Holocaust education that's about erasing Jewish civilization, right? It's like, you know, we find the most like non-Jewish seeming victims, right? We find the people who don't speak Yiddish, who aren't religious, right? Like those are the sort of the victims or survivors whose stories we're promoting. And so like, why are we participating in this Nazi project of erasing Jewish civilization? So to go to your question about this, here's where I see that it fitting into aspirations. I do see that there was the Jewish community did achieve something tremendous in getting Holocaust education into the public school curriculums. That was not something that was happening. And that was something that was an effort in the Jewish community that really, you know, did succeed for better or for worse in sort of making this a standard part of the curriculum for most non-Jews in the United States, and various, you know, different states have different rules about it, but it is very common. What I'm starting to propose, and I say this not in the book, but in the Sapir piece, is that there are ways that we can kind of flip this narrative and broaden on, I mean, you can say sort of like, if we were able to achieve this idea where we were able to get this Holocaust, you know, education into the curriculum. And yes, I would argue that there's a reason that was appealing to non-Jewish audiences or non-Jewish groups who were approving this. Imagine if we were to actually teach the content of Jewish civilization in public school. In public school, because think about what it says in a textbook about Jews, and this I talk about in the Sapir piece, right? Like, what does it say in a high school history textbook about Jews? Right? There's probably, if it has ancient history in it, maybe there's a page about the Israelites. It doesn't mention that those people were Jews, right? They might as well be Phoenicians. They're dead a long time ago. Who cares? And then there's like a chapter toward the end about the Holocaust. And from this, we learn that, like, you know, Jews are people who got murdered and their murders are there to like teach us some lesson about humanity or something, right? But there's nothing in between and there's nothing since. And what I think is amazing is like, think about like how much your whole curriculum would change if you did make Jews part of that story. Because, you know, Jews are not like bit players in Western civilization. Like, yes, there aren't a lot of Jews, which there's a reason for that. You know, there aren't a lot of Jews, but like, you know, this is not like, you know, the Yazidis, right? Like these are people who like are foundational to the history of the West. Judaism is foundational to the history of the West. You don't have Christianity and Islam without Judaism, right? And also Judaism is this counterculture that runs through the whole history of the West and really has a lot to teach people. And that's, you know, I've been ranting for a while here, but that's a, you know, that's what I go to in the Sapir piece is like what, in a sense, what non-Jews have to learn from Jewish history if we were to teach them something other than, you know, Jews got murdered in the Holocaust and isn't that sad?
My guess, just thinking out loud, especially given that mouse was just banned in a school district, I think in Tennessee, the chances of that happening are slight, given not just that, but broader currents. But my question, it really has more to do with the Jewish community itself, leaving public schools aside. Obviously, that would be great. Maybe it's a moonshot idea. It would be a moonshot idea for, and this is an essay we have in the current issue, to create something like universal Jewish literacy, yes, which includes not just language and religion, but also history, culture, literature, a sense among in the Jewish community about what the extent of their identity or what their identity encompasses when you move beyond the story of repeated victimization, or more recently, the risk of becoming the victimizer in turn, when you get out of that victimized or victimizer narrative. There's a point in your piece which really fascinated me, Dara, which is you said, you know, we can, as Jews, we can look back to past episodes in our own history. And obviously Zionism is probably the most obvious, although you can look to antecedents farther back. But you also suggested that we can also look at what other minority cultures have been able to do to change their trajectory, change their story, improve their, you know, to move forward. And I was wondering what you had in mind there.
With other minorities that have changed, yeah, so to speak?
Look, Jews can do a lot to learn more about themselves. We can probably do a lot to help ourselves by looking at the experience of others. You hinted that in your piece. And I was just wondering what you had in mind.
Well, so I only hinted it in the piece, right? I don't like have, I'm much more explicit in the other direction. But I think that, you know, look, I wasn't thinking this consciously when I was writing this book, but it's sort of since been pointed out to me by readers that I probably wouldn't have written this book if it weren't for sort of other movements in American cultural life that were about kind of pushing back against a dominant culture. So I'm thinking about things like the Black Lives Matter movement or the Me Too movement. You know, these are sort of like, you know, and I sort of, you know, to me, it's like, what's interesting is like how I maybe not even consciously, maybe absorbed some of those kinds of ways of thinking and was sort of exploring them when I was exploring these questions of like the way Jews are perceived in a non-Jewish culture. And, you know, and I hadn't thought of it that way consciously, but it's like, since the book came out, some of my readers have pointed this out to me that, like, you know, the way you're sort of talking about, you know, gaslighting, for example, is something I talk about a lot in the book. And they're like, you know, I probably wouldn't have like even used that kind of language if it weren't for something like the Me Too movement. You know, something like that probably sort of did seep into my consciousness. And, you know, those, you know, all those kinds of movements are like very small numbers of people, honestly, who are able to sort of change a conversation for better or worse. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, I love everything that these movements have done. But, you know, I think that there are ways that one can change a conversation. And I think that there are ways that you can sort of, you know, take a page from successful movements that have changed public conversations. So that's something where I do sort of see that, you know, that there's room for what, you know, so the way we think about the Jewish conversation too.
This is something that really, I don't know what quite to think about it. So I'm just curious about your reaction. You know, I also feel like Jews have failed in the last 30 or 40 years to really take a page from other minority groups that have been able to change their position culturally. And the way in which I think about it is that in the last 40 years, let's say maybe 50, especially as barriers, legal, formal barriers to integration went away, thanks to the Civil Rights Act, thanks to the Fair Housing Act, other pieces of legislation, you had a cultural transformation in this country as well. And I think by and large, a very healthy cultural transformation in which expressions of racism in culture became really absolutely taboo and risked total professional annihilation if you risked it. And we can have a conversation about whether this has gone too far and whether there's the sensitivities are excessive. But nonetheless, I think it's fair to say that we live in a better place where comedians don't feel like it's okay to stand up and tell nakedly racist jokes about sex or about ethnic communities and so on. Better, you know, this is a kind of, these are taboos that form a sort of moral hygiene in society, and they have real uses. In the Jewish experience, it's moved kind of in precisely the opposite direction, which is that thing that people never used to dare say about Jews or about Jewish identity, particularly when it's connected to Israel and Zionism, have now become okay. People make outrageously anti-Semitic comments, and even in the worst cases, the usual result is a professional wrist slap. It's not immediate professional and reputational annihilation. And here's where I want your reaction. I feel in a sense that the Jewish community has sort of participated in it, because we are the only minority in the United States that I can think of that when there are clearly obvious anti-Semitic events, we have a conversation with ourselves as to whether it's really anti-Semitic and whether we're not risking a kind of McCarthyism by calling comments that kind of walk the line of anti-Semitism by actually calling them out for what they are or what they suggest. People got upset by Ilhan Omar's comments, but there were plenty of people in the Jewish community who said, yes, they were microaggressions, but you know, let's face it that she's also being victimized in turn by Islamophobes. You know what I'm talking about. So the Jewish community has been lowering the bar, right, to what is permissible in terms of what can be said about Jews, while other communities have been raising the bar in terms of what is permissible. So what I was wondering about, if this was a convoluted story here, but if you can make sense of a observation that's merging on a question, should we be, is this one of these areas where we can say, you know, we need to find our inner outrage. We need to find our inner militant. We need to find our inner activist when it comes to what is becoming an explosion of anti-Semitism fed by tributaries, by other rivers that are coming from mainstream culture.
Yes. Well, so I have a lot of thoughts about this. you know, there's sort of, you know, I think that we are, I think there's reasons for this, which are the main reason in the American Jewish community is that the American Jewish community is extremely deeply invested in the idea of American exceptionalism. Extremely deeply invested. This is something I talk about in the book where when I talk about the legend of Ellis Island, you know, which is the story many American Jews have heard in their families about, you know, how we used to have some super Jewish sounding last name. And then, you know, there was this bumbling clerk at Ellis Island who magically accidentally changed our name to this less Jewish sounding one. Ta-da! Spoiler alert, it never happened. Nobody at Ellis Island even wrote down people's names. And what we really have are tens of thousands of court records from a generation after Ellis Island closed. I mean, you know, in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, of American Jews going to court and changing their own names. Why were they doing that? You know, today we talk about anti-Semitic incidents, but you know, in 1940, it wasn't about an incident. It was about like, you couldn't get a job, right? I mean, this is like very, very deep, you know, these are life-limiting things. You know, you couldn't rent an apartment. So, you know, that's something, that's a history that American Jews have buried. Like, we don't talk about it. We continue to believe the mythology in Ellis Island. We continue to commit ourselves to believing that this is like a completely, this country is a total exception to Jewish history. And we believe the sort of mythology, the American mythology of, you know, like the arc of history is long, but it bends toward justice, that there's this like linear progress. I mean, the, you know, and then people will say like, oh, how could you even talk about anti-Semitism when we have Supreme Court justices who are Jewish and senators who are Jewish and all these like titans in history, in culture and industry who are Jewish. And, you know, the reality though, is that all of those things that I just said, all of those things were true in 12th century Egypt. All of those things were also true in 10th century Spain, right? All those things were also true in, you know, 6th century Babylonia. So, you know, the idea that like, you know, that there's this like linear progression of history, it's like, no, it's more like in Judaism, in Jewish history, it's much more like a cycle. Right, it's like
also,
kind of a.
It was also true in 1920s Germany, I might add.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, even that, like, you know, people like that, they immediately jump to like, well, are we in 1920s Germany? Like, even that sort of bespeaks so much ignorance because it's like most of these situations in Jewish history don't end with mass murder of 6 million people. You know, most of them end with like people feeling humiliated and their lives being restricted, but not, you know, but not like with this like genocide. So, you know, so that's sort of part of the problem. But like, I think that as you said, you know, maybe my whole book is about finding that inner outrage because I feel like there are emotions that like you're not allowed to feel as an American Jew. And one of them is anger, right? And I think that, you know, but what's been interesting to me since I published this book is, you know, I've spoken with like people from these other minority communities about the book. You know, I've gone on like, you know, the woke black podcasts and whatever talking about this book. And what has surprised me is a lot of empathy from those communities who sort of, when I see it, when they see these ideas presented the way I've presented them in the book are sort of like, you're speaking my language. Now I get it. And they're like, I didn't know this before. This is like eye-opening to me. I've had people in the native communities reach out to me. I had somebody in the, somebody who runs a school that's mostly indigenous students in Canada who like contacted me and was like, I want copies of this book for all of my students because this is very familiar to them, this whole dynamic of, you know, the history being exploited and the living people being ignored or dismissed. So like, this is a very familiar topic. And one thing that's been sort of encouraging to me is that like, there are a lot of people in this country that like have a lot of goodwill and want to be better allies. And this is something, Brett, that you talk about in your piece in Sapir too, like that actually, you know, you hear about people who are pushing back against the Jewish community and hating the Jewish community, but like there's like a sort of a deep well of people who really maybe are very ignorant, but like actually have a lot of goodwill And, you know, I think we aren't really sort of reaching out to those communities maybe as much as we could. And that's something that you write about in your piece for Sapir. But that's something that I found, you write about it more in an international context. I found that even just in communities I've talked to about my book. I mean, like, I've been on Christian TV and like, there's a lot of people who have a lot of goodwill, but just a lot of ignorance. And I think that there's a lot of room for you know, connecting with those communities, but also, as you say, in, you know, raising the outrage level instead of lowering it, because I think that instinct to lower it is also very deep in Jewish history, because you have also thousands of years of Jewish history where the strategy of the community was to sort of like, you know, cooperate with whoever was in power. That was the strategy. I mean, that's the court Jew strategy that goes through like thousands of years of diaspora history. And for the most part, you know, I mean, we highlight the times when it didn't work, but it worked a lot. And so, I mean, there's a reason why, you know, the not antagonizing whoever's in power, whether in power means like, you know, the person in, you know, sitting in the government, it doesn't have to be the person sitting in the government though. It could be the person who's like, you know, the gatekeeper in the culture, as to go to your example.
Yeah, it's a fundamental dilemma, because there is a kind of wisdom to the strategy of being low-key, of self-effacement. It's one thing to call attention to yourself if in doing so you call attention to the ways in which you are weak and pitiable, right? It's another to call attention to yourself in the ways in which you are strong and enviable. And I think that has always been a kind of a deep-seated Jewish cultural dilemma here. And what's particularly difficult to communicate, it seems to me, is that being in one moment in time strong and enviable is actually a recipe for a communal disaster, right? Because there's nothing so vulnerable as a minority that finds itself envied as opposed to just dismissed or marginalized. We have about 15 or 20 minutes left, Dara, and I wanna make good on my promise to get to some of the questions that are populating the chat function. So I'm just going to look for something that's brief and to the point. Shelley Hebert asks, could you comment, Dara, about why anti-Semitism is being excluded from the DEI, that is diversity, equity, inclusion wave, sweeping through college campuses, and any thoughts on how to address it?
Well, yeah, so this goes to that sort of question, Brett, that you raised just before the questions about, you know, sort of like, oh, you know, Jews don't know how to react to this. Like, you know, do you present yourself as pitiable? Do you present yourself as enviable? This whole drama is itself a product of anti-Semitism, right? Because there's this anti-Semitism that I talk about in the book as Hanukkah anti-Semitism, which requires Jews to participate in their own erasure. You know, I go back to the story of Hanukkah where you had like teenage Jewish boys who were participating in Greek games and reversed, had their own circumcisions reversed so they could participate in Greek games.
I
don't even want to know how that was possible.
This is for another Sapir podcast.
Yes, it's Jewish self-erasure, right? You know, and then I give the example in the book also of like, you know, Jews in the, you know, in the Bolshevik Revolution, who were sort of participating in this, like, you know, we're not anti-Semitic, we're just anti-Zionist. That was the slogan of the, you know, of the Bolshevik Revolution in the 1920s, right? I mean, it's way before the State of Israel. They export that slogan.
100 years later, you can find exactly the same thing.
Oh yeah, right. But it's important for people to know that predates the State of Israel, right? I mean, that predates, and it comes directly from the Comintern. I mean, that's what's really amazing about that durable slogan. So to the question about sort of why are Jews not included in DEI, I mean, I did recently get a message from Google that wanted me to be like, you know, they're due for Google DEI. So not everybody, I mean, you know, that didn't go anywhere, but you know, there is room for change there. You know, but I think that the obvious reason why Jews are excluded from DEI is because of anti-Semitism. And what I mean by that is that the premise is that one of the foundations of anti-Semitism is the idea that Jews have too much power, right? That idea that like Jews are of this like magic conspiracy theory where like Jews have too much power and what we have to do is like make sure that Jews don't have more power. I think that a lot of people, like, the problem is like the whole like DEI discourse is around this idea of power and powerlessness. And so, in other words, people have bought into the anti-Semitic idea that, oh, Jews are powerful and privileged. And therefore, like, it makes, you know, it literally makes no sense. So that's why, I mean, I think that there's space for people to call them on this as BS. Because, you know, you wouldn't say to, you know, I mean, and actually, you know who does this? The British Jewish comedian David Baddiel has a book about that's more focused on this issue. It's called Jews Don't Count. His book is quite different from mine. He's very focused on anti-Semitism in progressive circles. But yeah, you know, one of the points he makes is that, you know, actually I think it's the wealthiest minority ethnic group in the United States and in the UK are actually Hindus. Like, nobody claims that, they have money, so they're good, right? And also, like, you know, I mean, also, like, other high income group is gay men.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where you have two male incomes. Yeah. You know, so, like, I mean, gay women, no, because those are tend to be much, you know, statistically much poorer. But, you know, gay men, these are people who, you know, especially white gay men, you know, nobody says, like, oh, white gay men are, they're not subject to discrimination because, you know, they have money and they're white. Like, you know, nobody's saying that. So, like, I mean, I think you have to just call people on the BS when it happens, right? I mean, that's the reality. And I think that we're reluctant to do that as Jews because of our history. And that goes back to our history in terms of, like, wanting to accommodate whoever's in power. But that's the place where I think we have to sort of redefine our priorities.
Let me ask you, this is Liz Wagner is asking, would Dara speak to the idea that focusing on the tragic aspects of our history has given Jews an excuse to hide from our own failures? I'll stop there.
Well, I don't think it's given us an excuse to hide from our own failures, but I think that it has actually given us, it's caused us to not focus on our successes. I'm going to throw that back at you in the inverse. Opening sort of moment that in my piece for Sapir, which is something that I don't write about in the book, is that the successes of Jewish culture are something that we don't celebrate because we're trying to sort of, you know, we've had this other strategy of promoting this, like, view of Jews as, like, tragic and pathetic and victims. But the successes of Jewish civilization are obvious to non-Jews. My piece in Sapir, and if we were to sort of promote and talk more about those, I think it might be very powerful. The opening scene in my piece I wrote for Sapir that we're talking about today is actually about a Hebrew conference. So I'm an academic in Hebrew and Yiddish literature. I went to an academic Hebrew conference in Seattle about 5 or 10 years ago. And, you know, everybody there is, like, you know, a Jewish academic who teaches Hebrew, but there were also these three people who sat in the back of all the conference sessions taking notes. And these people were from the Wampanoag Nation. These are Native Americans who are from Eastern Massachusetts. They're the people whose ancestors met the pilgrims in East 1620. They were at this Hebrew conference because they're, like, their goal was to revive Wampanoag as a spoken language. Wampanoag hasn't been spoken for 250 years. They were at this Hebrew conference because they're, like, we want to know how you did it. Because, you know, Hebrew is the only language in world history that's been successfully revived from being a non-spoken language to being now the native language of millions of people. So then they recognize that, like, nobody, like, told them to come to this Hebrew conference. They were sort of like, we want to know. And, you know, that to me is very powerful. I think that there's a lot of aspects of Jewish history that are like that, that are not about necessarily our failures, but about successes that we're not sharing.
The inspiration for my own essay in Sapir about winning the war of ideas happened about maybe 15 years ago at a synagogue in Cleveland, where I was the speaker, and at a reception before the speech, eating canapes or whatever, a Chinese woman who was a student at a business school, and I think at Case Western, introduced herself to me. She was from Shanghai, and I just said, well, you know, well, what brings you here? And she said, well, we want to learn from the smartest people in the world. These were her words. And I said, oh, come on, you know, that's ridiculous. And then she adamantly contradicted me by rattling off percentages of Jewish Nobel Prize winners in a variety of categories. I take it she'd done her research, but what I found fascinating was her insistence that this was a universal knowledge in China, right? That this was, and I thought, well, you know, it's funny how we've never really thought that there might be 1.5 billion or so people on Earth who are in a single country who are philo-Semitically inclined, and who think it's worth learning something from Jews and how they have how they have succeeded.
So I wanted to say, like, I do have a chapter in my book about China, and I find the philo-Semitism kind of problematic too. So I'm just going to mention that. And I also want to say, And I also just want to say something to the previous questioner's point where they were said, like, is this a way of dodging discussing Jewish failures? I don't agree that there's a shortage of conversations about Jewish failure. I feel like you go to any Jewish organization from a tiny little minion to, like, you know, Jewish Federations of North America, you go to any Jewish, to the Israeli government, you go to any Jewish conversation within the Jewish community, I feel like that's the only thing to talk about is Jewish failure. This is a very self-critical a very self-critical culture. And also, like, anything in Jewish literature, which is my field, in Yiddish and Hebrew literature, there's not a whole lot of patriotism in Yiddish and Hebrew literature about you know, hooray for the triumphs of the Jewish people. That's not what these Jewish writers are writing about. So I don't agree that there's an avoidance of discussing failures of the Jewish communities in Jewish culture. I think just the opposite is the problem. So, okay.
My friend Martin Krizel from Toronto, Canada, makes this point. Maybe instead of people loving dead Jews, people love Jews who assimilate and don't make Jewishness central to their personal identities. So people, especially Jews, don't really care about an employee at the Anne Frank Museum who wants to wear a kippah, or Orthodox Jews being beaten up in Brooklyn. Many people just can't send much sympathy towards Jews who pray in synagogue, who have separate sittings for men and women. Care to comment?
Yes. Well, so I spoke earlier about how we have this sort of flaw, in my opinion, this, like, fatal flaw in the way we teach about anti-bigotry education in this country, where the strategy has always been like, oh, see this group over here that's not similar, you know, that you might be prejudiced against. They're really just like you and me. They're just like everybody else. And then what that produces is this thing where, like, you know, even when we do Holocaust education, we talk about, like, you know, these, like, you know, the kid in Frankfurt who's on the soccer team, right? We don't talk about, like, the Hasidic kid from Galicia who's, like, a yeshiva bacher, right? But a lot of the people who died were that person, right? And so, and would that change the way we thought about, you know, and in the end of the book, I talk about attacks on the Hasidic community that happened just before the pandemic in New York and New Jersey. And what I did was I looked through all the press about those events, and I almost couldn't find a news article that didn't say something derogatory about the communities being attacked and the process of reporting the attack. And you absolutely did not see that with the attack, let's say, in Pittsburgh. And that's because it's like, you know, the people in Pittsburgh, like, oh, they're just like you and me. They're just like everybody else. Like, they don't have weird hairstyles. Whereas, like, you know, with the Hasidic community, it's kind of like, they're not just like you and me. And that means it's totally fine to, like, hack them with a machete, which is what happened in Muncie. You know, so that's absolutely something that I write about in the book. But the other thing that I, you know, sort of have really learned about this is that, you know, people who are attacking the Hasidic community, like, they're not, this is where maybe unless I misunderstood, I maybe disagree with the listener's question that they're not attacking, the people who are attacking the Hasidic community are, you know, and when I say attack, I mean these, like, physical violent attacks, you know, street attacks, things like that we've been seeing in the past several years. They're not doing it because they disagree with Haredi belief and practice. They're doing it because these people are visible. Yeah. That's all. Right. But, you know, and it goes to that point of, you know, that what I talked about earlier about Hanukkah anti-Semitism, which Hanukkah anti-Semitism requires the Jews participate in their own erasure. And there are many versions of that, like, very explicit version of that is reversing your circumcision. You know, but another example of that is, you know, the Jews who chose to change their last names. Right. And, you know, another version of that is, like, if even the way some aspects of Judaism have changed and evolved to sort of more resemble Christianity or Islam, depending on where those communities lived. So, you know, I mean, I think there's a lot of, I used to sort of really look at those dynamics more as, like, as, you know, sort of choices that Jews made themselves based on their own agency and within this tradition, like, oh, we, you know, they wanted to change the way they looked at this tradition because this tradition was fill in the blank that you don't like. I now sort of look at it really differently, and I sort of see, like, there's a lot of, you know, in the push-pull of the way people relate to Jewish identity, there's a lot of push, and, like, a lot more than I gave credit to.
This is a question from Mr. Alan Goldberg. I don't know if it's an invitation, and maybe this puts you on the spot, but if you were invited to speak at Yom HaShoah 2022, what would the title and focus of your talk be?
Well, as it happens, as you can imagine, I have many times been invited to speak on Yom HaShoah. Here's how on brand I am. Yom HaShoah is my birthday. Could not make this up. But yeah, and also my son's birthday. So my birthday, well, I don't care about my son. I can't do things on his birthday because I'm going to hang out with him. But I actually am participating. There is a project that is happening Erev Yom HaShoah, so it doesn't affect my son's birthday. The Hartman Institute was developing something called Hitkansut. It's a gathering. This was sort of a project that originated in Israel, where they're trying to create, basically, sort of as you know, you no longer have a generation of survivors. They're creating sort of more of like a formalized ritual for Yom HaShoah. It's almost like a Yom HaShoah Seder. Like they have like a Haggadah basically that has like a structure like a Seder. That brings you through different rituals and different different types of readings and different types of ways of connecting to this story that you know involve the participation of the person. But this is for within the Jewish community. And I was actually part of a group that was adapting this for the North American Jewish community because you know we have different different cultural different priorities than the Israeli community. So I was involved in that. So I already have an answer to you in terms of like what I would be doing. That's sort of for within, sort of a way of reframing Holocaust memory for within the Jewish community. Because I'm not arguing that like Holocaust memorialization is like something we shouldn't do. But I do think that there's sort of two categories for it. There's one, which is the way we think about it within the Jewish community. And then the way we think of it outside the Jewish community, I would sort of I can't give you a pithy title right now off the top of my head, but I would be pushing for sort of much more focus on if we're gonna be here commemorating the Holocaust, much more focus on a deep dive into the culture that was actually destroyed in the Holocaust. And that would mean like reading Yiddish literature, for example.
Anita Silvert wants to know, how do we define what quote unquote baseline Jewish cultural literacy includes looks like?
Well, so this is something that other people in the issue have written about. And this is a subject that's actually really close to my heart. You heard I have a PhD in Yiddish and Hebrew literature, but my mother has a PhD in Jewish education. So this is something that I sort of grew up with and have spent my whole life doing in terms of, my writing and also my, work with children and things like that. What does baseline Jewish literacy look like? I mean, there are people smarter than me who have created curricula around this. But one thing I will say is I think that, and I love the ideas in this issue for creating universal Jewish literacy. Because I will tell you that as a parent of four children, this is hard because, you sort of have a lot of not great options because, even if you have the option, of a Jewish day school, Jewish day schools often have this bifurcated thing where they're here's Jewish studies and here's general studies. So it's they're getting the same social studies textbook that the kids in the public school are getting. Why are they reading that same public school textbook where Jews are erased from the story? Right? They have English, they have literature classes, and their literature class is reading the same thing that the kids in the other school are reading. Why? Why are they not learning Yiddish literature? Why are they not learning Israeli literature? Right? Why are they not learning the history of Israel? Why is it okay, we're doing Tanakh and Talmud and all the Jewish courses, and then we're doing our secular curriculum? There's something really missing here. Why are those two different people, two different teachers? So that's a flaw, I think, in the day school curriculum. And then you have the problem of for people for whom day school is not, who are not involved in day school, which by the way, includes my four children who are public school students and also includes me. And I'm one of four siblings. None of us ever went to a Jewish school. Where do you get the material? What other sources do you have outside of outside of public school? My kids have private tutoring in Hebrew language. It's incredibly expensive. Not as expensive as Jewish day school, but it was hard to find. It was hard to find teachers who were willing to do that. That's what something my kids have. I recently, in the past 5 years, my kids have done these courses that are from Bar Ilan called Lookstein Online Virtual Academy. And they've done courses through them that are designed by these educators at Bar Ilan where they do things like the history of the state of Israel from the Zionist movement until, the early 2000s. My kids have done those courses, right? They've done also all the sort of courses they have in Jewish texts. They've done that through Lookstein, but it's there's some teacher, they're on Zoom with from Bar Ilan, right? But it's why is this hard to find? right? Like, it shouldn't be hard to find. There should be a lot, you know, and why is what's easy to find, like, the thing that's like, come play basketball with other Jewish kids? Like, that's easy to find. The come take a course in the history of the state of Israel so that, like, when you get to college and people are yelling something anti-Zionist at you, you actually know something about it before. Like, there isn't really a way to learn about that. Like, they're not, like, they're, I mean, it was hard to find a course for kids or not even kids, high school kids, about the history of the state of Israel. Like, it shouldn't have been so hard to find. So, yeah. So I think that there's a lot to be said about sort of, you know, getting to universal Jewish literacy. But to me, that was the most important proposal that was expressed in this book of in the Moonshot issue.
So Dara, that's a good way to wrap this up. I have a sense that many people on this call could be here and listen to you for another hour, but I want to be respectful of people's time. I think there's a reason which you've just demonstrated why your conversation, among some really terrific conversations we've had in Sapir, yours was the most subscribed, because I think you have touched a nerve in the Jewish community. I think you've inspired a lot of people with this book, but with so much of your past work. Anyone who's listening in who hasn't read Dara's really outstanding essay in Sapir, do so. And then I would commend the other 17 essays. They're just marvels. I would commend one in particular, in addition to Andres Spokeni's beautiful essay on universal Jewish literacy, which is Natan Sharansky and Gil Troy's, I think, superb recommendation to create a gap year in Israel that will be able to any young Jews, or at least nearly as many young Jews as Birthright has. Take your teenager, give them the option of a year off, but not just a year off anywhere, a year that will change their lives and change their sense of their identity. So I would commend that essay in addition to all the others. Thanks so much again for taking a little more time, Dara. I think this is important for this community and for these conversations that we're having. And I really, again, I want to come back to thanking our audience, which has been incredibly focused and engaged and smart. I'm sorry I wasn't able to get to all of the questions, but it's, I think, a taste of what we're trying to do at Sapir. So have a great week. I hope no wars begin in Central Europe this week. And we have a whole series of conversations up ahead. And again, to the extent that you can spend some hours with Sapir, I think it's good for us, but even better for you. So thank you.
Thanks so much, Brett. This is terrific to speak with you. Thank you.
Take care, Dara. Thanks again.
Thank you.